want to share with us a little bit more about the magic of three. These triangles that we've used time to time are, of course, just a rational model of mine, but these rational models have been especially magical for pointing to the basic dynamics of reality. Maybe you were clear out with that kind of trying to work, maybe not. Anyway, the name for the biggest triangle was right in the middle, and in this little analysis, reality is the name in the middle here. Or the name of this central triangle might also be God. Whole triangle is God. Or the whole triangle is reality. For God in Christian theology is a devotional word for reality. It speaks of an attitude toward reality, devotion, commitment, dedication, and so forth. We had a little discussion yesterday about the content of Christian theology. Or I guess the method of Christian theology. Well, the content of Christian theology is your life. And there is no other content in Christian theology. The whole of your life is the content of Christian theology. And there is no other content. The Christian words do not have content to your life. They speak of an attitude toward that content. When you call reality God, you are not adding anything to reality. You are just adding a devotion to the reality you're talking about. When you use the word Christ, you're not adding anything to redemption. You're just putting a marker on that redemption that makes it clear to you it's redemption. When you use the Holy Spirit, you're not adding anything whatsoever to the essence of human existence. You're just calling it holy. You get that? There is no content to the words of Christian theology. The only content there is in Christian theology is your life. Now, there are three and only three approaches to reality. Only three approaches to truth, to the truth of reality. Just three and only three. And here they are. There's an approach we will call the "it is" approach. And there's an approach we will call the "I am" approach. And there's an approach we will call the "we do" approach. Three approaches to reality. The "it is" approach is also called the scientific approach to reality. It sees reality as facts. That tree is a fact. That table is a fact. This floor is there. And this is a pure experience we have. We all agree that the floor is there and just will not move down by pounding on it. And Richard Feynman one time was asked how you get to a new natural law. How do you find a new natural law? And he said, this is the process of finding a new natural law. In terms of what you know about life already, you guess what the new natural law is, and then you devise a test for that guess. And if the test fails, you guess again. And if your better guess survives the test that you designed to test it, then that is a new natural law. Temporary, until some further exploration transcends it. For this is the nature of all natural law. It's temporary. It's approximate. It will be seen in larger ways, different ways, as time moves on. Now this process of the it approach to truth is a very simple thing. It is just the way life, not just human life, but all life is always functioning. Let's take a dog, for example. A dog is not born with wisdom about the nature of a porcupine. This is learned experience. And this is the way the dog learns it. He sees this animal and he anticipates food. And so as he approaches this food item, he gets a quill in the nose. A learning experience. His guess about the future didn't work out quite the way he anticipated. So he guesses again and is more cautious about how to win this food, or at least fully this animal, so that no more quills in the nose take place. This is the scientific approach to life. And every one of us does it. We couldn't walk up a flight of stairs or get to the bathroom or eat our supper without the scientific approach to truth. It just goes on. Now, in the scientific approach to truth, there's this strange vision of time. Past, one end of the line, future is the other, and there's a dot, infinitesimal dot, that separates the past and future, and that's all in the present. Now this is just a model in the mind of every dog and every human. Every dog has an ingrown memory system in his brain. It has images of the past. And when he sees this next porcupine, these images of the past experience rerun in his mind. He sees the porcupine in the terms of those reliance. He anticipates the future in terms of those reliance. He then acts accordingly. This is just the way minds work. They just have this system going on. It's ingrown in your biology. Past, future, and time. But this is an abstract idea. Or an abstract set of relationships by which your mind functions. When you move to the I approach to life, this is the contemplative approach. This is the approach to life of looking down inside your own subjectivities. This is your own subjectivity, looking at your own subjectivity and the kind of experiences that your own subjectivity has. And in this world, it's always one time. Now. This infinitesimal point is never, ever experienced. Or it's experienced as an abstract idea. Just now. Yes, there's a kind of a flow of this now. Things change. But my memories are memories that are taking place now. My anticipations are anticipations that are taking place now. My experience flow, in that sense, past and future, but all this flow is flowing through now with memory, anticipation, operating. Now, as I look deeper and deeper in my inquiry into the I am, I see that I am not my mind. My mind is a very real experience. But, and I can analyze and think about it, it's probably just the interior working of my brain. But I don't even experience the brain. The brain is something you can experience by scientifically tearing apart somebody's skull and looking. But you don't see the mind when you tear apart somebody's skull. You just see brain cells doing weird things and electrical and chemical things. But when you look inside, you don't see the brain, you see the mind. And I think probably it's true that the mind is simply the brain functioning in a relationship to your consciousness in such a way that you could use it as a tool to live your life. If you look into this interior world of consciousness and viewing consciousness, you also see your feelings. Again, your feelings are not who you are. They're not your consciousness. They're just your body doing what your body does. Your body coughs up all kinds of sensations, pain, pleasure. It coughs up all kinds of emotional qualities. The section of your brain working, all mammals are highly emotional beings. And these emotions and so forth give you a lot of help in getting clear what's going on in the world around you. I mean, when you see a snake, the emotion of fear helps you. When you are approaching the dream girl of your life, the experience of falling in love helps you. And so all these feelings, whatever they are good in themselves because they just help you experience your life. They are your life being experienced. But those feelings are not you. And one thing we have to always remember about feelings, they're temporary. I don't care how horrible your feelings are right now, the good news is, it won't last. No matter how wonderfully ecstatic the experiences you're having right now are, they won't last. Feelings just have this nice curve. They sort of rise quickly and fade. Even this intense grief that you had, or the intense loss of something in your life, there's a grieving period, but it goes away. Unless you just hang on, hang on, hang on, hang on, hang on. You can make grief last forever if you work at it. But if you just let grief, it passes. Your consciousness can also be conscious of your consciousness. And as you push consciousness of consciousness to the bottom, what you experience is what we call Holy Spirit. And we have said the Holy Spirit consists of three things. We've got to make this try and break down here a little bit with a better marker. T stands for trust. S stands for freedom. L stands for love or compassion. And trust is in relationship to the whole of reality, actually. So let's try to get a hold of trust and get a hold of the it is experience when it's pushed to the bottom. When you push the scientific experience to the bottom, what you experience is just the sheer mystery of it all, as the human being experiences that. The scientific method itself doesn't deal with mystery. It just deals with facts. But when you really push science to its edges, you come up with weirdness. We just cannot imagine what light is. I'll give that illustration. Is it a wave? Is it a particle? Yes and no. We don't know what light is. We can't even imagine. And many other things in physics turn out that way. Unimaginable. Even the Big Bang that we talk about is kind of unimaginable. And you can yell out that unimaginableness with a question like this. Well, what was before the Big Bang? And the answer that I found most revelatory is infinite science. Or, another word for infinite silence, is the no thingness out of which all things came and come. The no thingness into which all things return. And then you ask the rhetorical question, well, where is infinite silence now? And the congregation answers, everywhere. For the final end, the final fact, is also the everything.
communities through vats,
weld themselves together in a vat that I have called and others have called a total demand. The total demand here is to be your being. The total demand here is to acknowledge the fact that this is what you're over against, actually, unavoidably, inescapably. And so this is the first part of trust. And I call this part of trust, put it in here again, so you can see the initials, transparent attention. TA, transparent attention. It's not a rational knowing. It's just an attention to the fact that no thing is no thing is no thing is no thing that is experienced in your life. That this everything is a thing is a thing that is experienced in your life. That this total man is actually experiencing. Just attention. Transparent attention. Now, my most wonderful scripture illustration of total demand, transparent attention is that sixth chapter of Isaiah, in which Isaiah has just experienced the death of a very fine ruler of Israel called Uzziah. He wasn't a perfect ruler, but from Isaiah's perspective, he was the John Kennedy of his time. He was the, maybe the Obama of his time, I don't know, but he was a leader with whom phenomenal expectations were invested by Isaiah and everybody. And the man died of some dreadful disease. And in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the king, the no thing that's out of which all things come and all things turn. I saw it. I went to the temple, Isaiah said, and there it was, sitting on the throne. Except it was kind of fuzzy, because there were seraphim flying around in front of it. Some of the wings of the seraphim covered his face, so I couldn't see God's face. And some of the wings of the seraphim covered his feet, so I couldn't see his feet. And with the rest of the wings, they kept flying, flapping. Seraphim are all figures. That's a helpful way to translate all the angels in the Bible. They are messengers from God, who is the author, and they are messengers of all, charging down into your transparent attention. So, facing all these flapping off figures, communicating to Isaiah the king, and he just sees it right there in front of him in the temple, he says, "Woe to me, I'm undone." He can feel the temple shake. The whole religious mode of his times, rumbling, shaking like this. And he said, "My God, I'm a liar. I've been talking about God in ways that are just sentimental shit. On my lips are dirty. I'm just nasty-lipped. I've been telling illusions. I've been giving sentimental talk in my churches, in my synagogues, in my family life." And at that point, one of the seraphim comes running across the sanctuary with a burning coal from the altar and singes Isaiah's mouth and explains to Isaiah that his dirty mouth is forgiven. What a story we got here. Yeah. And literally, Isaiah is sort of stunned there with his forgiven mouth. And he hears God talking. Three angels, I guess, because God said, "We," said, "Well, whom shall we send? And who will go for us?" God is saying to his angels. And Isaiah is listening in on this. And here he is with singed mouth and lying in the past, standing there right facing the truth. And Isaiah says, "Well, here I am. And want to hear what you have to say. And Hanukkah is at the back, well, how long do I have to do this? And the divine voice communicates, as long as it takes. Don't think about that. Now that is a wonderful illustration of facing the total demand of the infinite and experiencing your sin and your calling. Now, this is also what Tilly is pointing to in this wonderful paragraph. Grace writes us when we're in great pain and restlessness. It writes us when we walk through the dark valley of a meaningless and empty life. It strikes us when we feel that our separation is deeper than usual. Because we've violated another life, we've been lying and lying and lying and lying and lying and lying. A life that we loved, or from which we were estranged. It strikes us when our disgust for our own being, our indifference, our weakness, our hostility, and our lack of direction and composure have become intolerable to us. It strikes us when year after year the longed for perfection of life does not appear. When the old compulsions reign within us as they have for decades. When despair destroys all joy and courage. That is a paragraph on transparent attention. But when you pay attention to God, you also get to pay attention to sin. Because the experience of God and the experience of sin is the one and the same experience. Once you see the reality that is the reality that is the reality, you see that you have run away. You see that you have dirty lips. You see that you are an escape artist of high skill. And you may also see, as Tillich says you can see, that this is a losing game. That if you are running away from reality, you've got a real run on your hands. Because reality is chasing you down and he's faster. That you are. If you are trying to beat reality, fight with reality, and win, you are on a losing game. Reality is going to win. So what this means is that if you are dedicated to winning over reality or escaping reality, you are in a losing game. Your life is just flat hopeless. This is also called despair. So all these little descriptions of despair are just experiences of finding yourself caught, running away from the what is, and therefore in the losing game called despair. Philip goes on to say, at that same moment as you experience all that, sometimes a wave of light breaks through our darkness, and its strong force is saying to us, you're accepted. You're accepted by that which is greater than you. A name of which you do not know. Calling God sort of late theological experience. Your first experience of God is just, God is nameless. There's no name for it. My little name here, no nameless, is just another word for no name. Every nameless is another word for no name. Things have names, but God has no name. He is the nameless. In fact, there are traditions in the Old Testament that you can't even pronounce the word God in public. And in fact, when they wrote it in the Old Testament Hebrew, they left out the vowels. You know, let's put in the consonants, make sure you didn't pronounce it. The names, the how, the awesome. The awesome says you're accepted. I was up at Welcome Home as an interpretation of acceptance. That you're welcome home to reality, despite the fact that you've seen clearly that you're a fly artist, a fight artist against reality. Reality is just fine, but you're coming home. There's no penalty to be, no probation period, there's no punishment wrapped that way. It's just the punishment was being away. Now you're home. Welcome, you know, have a feast. Wonderful. That's the second part of trust. I call it universal forgiveness. It's there for you, and it's there for everybody. And then the third part of trust is, as Philip puts it, do not try to do anything. Twice later you will do much. Do not seek for anything. Do not perform anything. Do not attend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are welcome home to reality. Yeah, you may do much once you get through that, but not now. Just, I call this also effortlessly letting be. Effortlessly letting be. If you are struggling to be a man or a woman of faith, you don't know what you're talking about. There's no struggle involved. Faith is built into your genes. Faith is built into your DNA. Faith, trust, occurs in children before they learn something different. Well, you and I as adults have learned a lot of ways to be in distrust of reality. A lot of ways to be in tremendous disharmony with the way life is. That's what the struggle is about. The struggle is about giving up all that shit. Trust takes no struggle. It's just a sort of opening up to reality. And you can see why that's called trust. I mean, you're just going to walk right into the face of reality, vulnerably. You're going to just take life as it comes and whatever does come. And that trust is invincible. Because if you trust reality, what is there to distrust? Because this is everything. If you trust the source of everything, your trust will not be taken away from you. If you trust the United States of government, you may be let down. If you trust your family, you may be let down. If you trust your own ability to do X, Y, and Z, you'll find you're letting down yourself. But if you trust reality, whoo, it's eternal rest. The war's over. You can just trust. Lay back on your cot and relax. Some of you do not believe this. That's it. It's a trust. And when you trust, you also can notice in what your interior inquiry into the I am that something called freedom is also who you are. It's almost like freedom sort of flows from trust. Or maybe you have to trust to be able to notice freedom. Because what freedom means is liberation from your own ego, your own idea of who you are, your own habits of personality. It means liberation from what your culture tells you is true and not true. It means liberation from all of the teachings that you've believed in the past. It's just a regular huge liberation. I've broken down freedom as liberation from ego, from good and evil, and from pleasure. When you merge with your freedom, you are beyond ego. You are beyond good and evil. That is, all of the structures of your mind, all of your psychological wisdom, you're beyond that. You're liberated from what you think the human psyche works, like how you think the human psyche works. You're liberated from it. So you can watch and see how the human psyche does work. You're liberated from all your political positions. So you can look and see what actually would be good, what actually would be workable. You're liberated from all your sociology, all your theological tradition, you're just liberated from everything. structures of the mind, you're liberated. And you're liberated from faith, in the sense of what they've always told you, it's going to always work out this way. Life is just sort of fate. It's just a record that's set, and you're just a victim. No. You're liberated from all sense of victim. Which is comforting in its way, because it's tough to be a slave. But being a slave is sometimes comforting. Because if I'm not a slave, then I can't blame other people for my problem. If I'm really beyond fate, then everything I'm doing is my fault. I don't get to say, I'm doing this because my mother. I'm doing this because I had a bellyache. I'm doing this because, etc. No, there's no because. I'm doing this. I'm opting myself to do this. And I'm opting myself to do this. And now I'm opting myself to do this. And that's the end of the story. There's no blame in somebody else for my opting. Well, this is the rediscovery of your opting possibility. Now love. Love is an equus, says Paul, and so is Buddhism. And love comes in three parts too. Magic of three. Love of self. Love of others. And love of the crown of our deeds. Love of the full ground. Love of God. Let's look at love of self as an experience. Love of self in this context, in this realistic context, doesn't mean indulging your personality, indulging your silly substitute for who you are that you've built up called your self-image. No, it means loving your reality, loving who you really are, loving the strength that creation has put into your being. I call this category poetic name. Autonomous strength. You're alone in a situation of strength. That is your real life. You are stronger than all hell. That's who you really are. One of my favorite illustrations now of autonomous strength, of self-love, is the goddess Kali. That I am the goddess Kali. You remember my story about her, yes. She is a goddess with a two-edged sword in her hand, blood on both sides of the blade. And around her belt are the skulls of what she has slain. But she is the slayer of falsehood. When fundamentalism says, well, Jesus was really raised from the grave bodily and walked around on earth. That's autonomous strength. Well, every miracle of the body is literally true. Or more likely, somebody comes up to you and says, I cannot love a God who killed my son. Well, you have to say something like this. You're asking the wrong question. Your question is, are you going to open yourself to this situation? Are you going to accept the grief that you're grieving and let that grief flow into its conclusion over the years ahead? Or are you going to fight the situation? Are you going to live the rest of your life in despair because you've lost your son? That is the situation. You can see the compassion in that for that person. But boy, you can see the against a theology that sees God as some beneficial father up here that's always going to do just exactly what you want done in the way you want it done, when you want it done. You're asking for a new relationship to realize. You're asking to say God before and to and with whatever is happening. So loving yourself is a two-edged sword, slaying every fractious falsehood that comes your way. You can see the strength in that. Some of you were struggling last night with thrusting. You found thrusting, the dance move of thrusting a little harder than some of the others. Well, when you say that you are the goddess calling, you get your thrust back.
Seen that, say, let's look at what we do. The we
content, but it has to do with the fact that it's not enough to see into your own being. It's not enough to have a good scientific view of things. But then what do we do with it as a human society? And some people like Plato took what he learned about I am from Socrates, what he learned about this from earlier science, and put together Platonism. He was trying to build a consensus for Greek society and how it could best run. And a lot of Greek society thought that his pulling together was a good one. And in fact, even Kierkegaard said, a whole century later, that all philosophy up again was a footnote on Plato. Then Aristotle, however, saw that Plato's overview was not adequate to him, and so he created Aristotelianism as his overview. Well, now, we wrote this little document, The Road, or some of us are still writing The Road of God. This is just a consensus of the five of us who are writing that thing. Although we've included a lot of other people in the consensus building, all of us, we've read all of them. But we're trying to build an overview that would give meaning to the we of the people of God in our time. And we're using all the scientific knowledge that we have. We're using all of the sense of what it means to be human that we have to put together, to create a consensus for common living in the world. That little article on the next Christianity. A bunch of us have pulled together stuff on that. Joyce and Alvin and I just did the last edition. And we've got another edition to do, but you will all help. We're building consensus there. There's no absolute nature of that document. There's fallen down from heaven. It's just a consensus. It's a recreation of what it means to be the resurgence of the church in this moment in history. What it means to get loose from Christendom and be the next edition of being a follower of Jesus. That's what that consensus is about. And this we experience can describe what goes on in the CRC. A CRC, or any aspect of being the true church, is three things. Isn't that interesting? It's always three things. And the first thing it is, it's the hospital. The hospital for sin sick souls. So when your CRC member comes in, door, he said, oh good, another patient. Come into the hospital. And what do? In your hospital, you do this right here. You help each member be transparently attentive to the way reality is and how they're run away from it. Confession, you sometimes call that, right? And you help them to remember that we're all forgiven, no matter what the hell state they be. And then you beckon them to step out of their safe boats into the real waters of life, living openly to reality. That's why it's a hospital. It heals people. Because this experience of trust, the birth of trust, is called grace. So it's sometimes called the church, the means of grace. So that's what you're out to do in the hospital. Means of grace. The second thing up here is the vanguard, I call it. Being the vanguard in history. We have worked this to death, this great symbol, that once you experience this call, embody it, and work with it, you find yourself that rare part of humanity that's responding to reality rather than fleeing from reality. And that we believe as a lecture we will give this morning. Then this third one, I want to talk about this third one. This sermon is called The Communion of Saints. Houston got a hold of this issue pretty well, I thought, the other night, when he talked about his teachers, Joyce and me, and then our teacher, Matthews, and then Matthew's teacher, Richard Niebuhr, and Richard Niebuhr's teachers, Jonathan Edwards, and Pascal, Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, the Apostle Paul. Jesus. He could have gone on, you know.
Yeah.
And Jeremiah and Amos and Jacob and Abraham. Could have gone a long way there. This strain of teachers, this tradition of witnesses, is part of the meaning of this communion of saints. And again, this is just the way reality is for anybody, whatever tradition you're in, whatever race you belong to. And get a feel of that. I've never read anything better than this bit of poetry from Kazakhs, the Savior of God. Maybe this is one of your favorite books, too. Anyhow, this is actually a passage that won me to this book. The dead do not lie in the ground. They have become ideas and passions. They determine your will and your actions. Future generations do not move far from you in an uncertain time. They live, desire, and act in your loins and your heart. In this lightning moment when you walk the earth, your duty is to live through the endless march, both visible and invisible, of your own being. You are not one isolated individual. You are a body of troops. One of your faces lights up for a moment under the sun, then suddenly it vanishes, and another, a younger one, lights up behind you. Your tradition, your race, from which you come, is a huge body of the past, the present, and the future. It is the face itself. You are a passing expression. You are the shadow. It is the meat. You are not free. Myriad invisible hands hold your hands and direct them. When you rise in anger, great-grandfather frosts at your mouth. When you make love, an ancestral caveman growls with lust. When you sleep, tombs open up in your memory until your skull brims with ghosts. Your skull is a pit of blood around which the shades of the dead gather in myriad flocks to drink of you and be revived. Do not die, we may not die, the dead cry out within you. We had no time to enjoy the women we desired, be in time, sleep with them. We had no time to turn our thoughts into deeds. Turn them into deeds. We had no time to grasp and crystallize the face of our hope. Make it burn. Finish our work. Finish our work. All day and all night we come and go through your body and we cry out. No, we have not gone. We have not detached ourselves from you. We have not descended into the earth. Deep in your entrails, we continue the struggle. Deliver us. It's nothing to hear the tumult of the ancestors within. It is not enough to feel them battling at the threshold of your mind. All rush to clutch your warm brain and climb once more into the light of day. But you must choose with care whom to hurl down again into the chasms of your blood, and whom you shall permit to mount once more into the light of the day. Do not pity them. Keep vigil over the bottomless gulf of your heart and choose. You shall say, this shade is humble, dark like a beast. Send it away. This one is silent and flaming, more living than I. Let him drink all my blood. Enlighten the dark blood of your ancestors. Shape their cries into speech. Purify their will. Widen their narrow and merciful brows. For you are not just a slave of the past. As soon as you were born, a new possibility was born with you. A free heartbeat stormed through the great sunless heart of your race. Whether you would or not, you brought a new rhythm, a new desire, a new idea, a fresh soul. Whether you would or not, you enriched the ancestral body. So where are you going? How shall you confront life and death? Verse 2. all the race takes refuge in your grace. It asks questions there and lies waiting in agony. You have a great responsibility. You do not govern now only your own small, insignificant existence. You are a throw of the dice on which, for a moment, the entire fate of your race, of your tradition, is being gathered. Everything you do reverberates through a thousand destinies. As you walk, you cut open and create the riverbed through which the stream of your descendants shall enter and flow. When you shake with fear, your terror branches out into innumerable generations, and you degrade innumerable souls before or behind you. And when you rise to a valorous deed, all your race, all your tradition, rises with you and turns valorous. I am not alone. I am not alone. Let this vision inflame you at every moment. Now, if that is not on the communion of saints, I never read anything on it. What a poem. Okay, I'm done here. I'm a little late. We're supposed to leave about right now for a break. But I want to have some theological conversation that seemed like we weren't quite finished with, especially around the idea of the content of theology, the methodology of theology, and how we talk about these things, the languages that we need to talk about, and who are we to talk to. So why don't we take a break? Do a little thinking on our own. What are our questions about any of this or any other thing might be? And let's field some of those questions and discuss them among ourselves when we come back. So see you in 15 minutes. That's 5 till the hour of last.